You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahi ahi mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko mea toka ingoa.
Ko sauf toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. Kia ora mea, how are you this week?
Hello, I'm good. Yes, how are you?
I'm good. I'm excited for the show. I feel like we have some great things to chat about today.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited.
I'm really excited. Do tell, what have you got?
Yeah, I caught up with artist Emma Fitz about her current exhibition on at Melanie Roger Gallery, Emerald Pool. Soph, what have you got?
I had a corridor with artist Lucy Mail about her solo exhibition Phone Tree, currently on in the changing room at Gus Fisher Gallery.
He aha o whakaro, we'd love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patahi mai, you can text us on 5395-5395. Or Waimarane, give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also, after the show, koe e ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō hei pakihere roki roki maronga i te pai tuku tuku o Erirangi Poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
What's it all for?
Various Artists.
Lucy Mail is a Tāmaki-based artist whose practice primarily explores our relationship with animals, examining and questioning the limits of human conjectures about them as a relational investigation rather than a scientific inquiry. Predominantly working in sculpture and publication, Mail embraces the absurd, gathering and assembling archive found objects, drawing and casting into material relation. In her current solo exhibition in the changing room at Gus Fisher Gallery, Phone Tree, Mail has turned her interests in human and animal relationships to moths, reframing moth traps as holders of moth narratives, as inadvertent collectors capturing moth memory, drama, and dreams. In Phone Tree, Mail presents five moth situations, each embodying a different kind of moth and reimagining its trap into a new form, reflecting its potential experience, memory, or navigation of the world as a moth, an act of anthropocentric guesswork of their interiority. Enveloping these situations are large-scale drawings on the walls, made of this moth-eaten-looking tissue paper, layered, collaged, and hole-punched, creating this playful exploration of scale within the space. Imagining the interior lives of moths in such detail, Mail has turned these moth traps as devices of surveillance and control into portals of reconsideration of our relationships with them, reorienting our pre-existing ideas of the lives and world of moths. I had a kōrero with Lucy Mail about Phone Tree and her overall practice.
I'm Lucy Mail and I work in sculpture, but for me that encompasses a lot of different things. So it can be objects or it can be video, drawings, publication especially, and images. And really the concern of my practice is humans' relationship with animals and how that has changed across history. So I often look for something strange or interesting or funny in history and then think about what might be the kind of contemporary parallel to that in our environment. And I'm especially interested in animals that are in our everyday. So not like the distant animal, but the close by animal, because I feel like that is where a lot of our assumptions are kind of under-recognised.
Through drawing, sculpture and intricate lace work, your current exhibition at Gus Fisher Gallery, Phone Tree, sees you reframing moth traps as objects of surveillance and control, instead as holders of moth narratives, as inadvertent collectors of moth memory, drama and dreaming. I wanted to start this conversation around Phone Tree by speaking to its beginnings. Where did this body of work kind of gain its initial momentum? Was there a specific idea or experience that really kickstarted your approach to this project?
Yeah, it came maybe like a few years ago, and I was in the UK and I was like doing the rounds of all the big institutional galleries and museums and things like that. And I became obsessed with like finding and seeing the moth traps that all galleries and museums have somewhere because they're trying to kind of take care of their collection. But I started to kind of notice how they were trying to hide them or make them pretty, or allow them to blend in and kind of like down in low places or up on top of shelves or vitrines and things like that. So I was like obsessed with fossicking those things out, and I started to take photos of all these examples of moth traps in these places.
Mm.
This kind of relates to my own personal experience of being like obsessed with the moths in my own house and like being worried whenever I see a moth like come out of the pantry or like come out of my wardrobe, and like then immediately zoning in on where did that moth come from, and how many of them are there, and have I got a moth problem. So I could see like the parallels between the institutional spaces and also like my own experience of moths. And seeing these traps then led me to kind of start my own research about where do they buy these moth traps from. So the galleries will buy their moth traps from specific places that are to do with like preservation. And then that allowed me to find a whole bunch of other styles or forms of moth traps that are directed at different types of moths. So like moths that are agricultural pests as opposed to clothing moths, for example. So yeah, that was the start of the obsession, was observing something and then that becoming a starting point for further research and interest and kind of unfolding the form of the moth trap.
Mm, that's so interesting. I didn't realise that kind of starting point started in a gallery itself. Like when you think of moths, you think of it as being in more of a domestic space, as you said, which was also, I guess, a bit of a starting point. But it's really cool how you've taken something from the gallery that's been so hidden and then made it the whole space in a gallery.
Yeah, what is really interesting as well is like in previous exhibitions I've done, there have been like these moth things kind of come up. Like often galleries will ask you, are you bringing anything natural into the museum?
Mm.
And if so, then you have to get it like sequestered for 24 hours to make sure you're not bringing in more bugs into the environment.
Mm.
And also one exhibition I was in, somebody like they emailed me prior to coming down to install the show and they were like, look, we have a moth problem. Just wanted to tell you that we have a moth problem. Are you bringing down anything that could be eaten by the moths? And so, like, it really just starts to build up. Like, the pattern of interest starts to build up over time.
Mm.
And I think that's what then made me look and, like, notice the moth traps in the galleries. You know, so, like, these kind of intrusions into my everyday or how I expect things to work, right? How that galleries are these kind of sealed places, when in actual fact they're not, and they're always waging some kind of war against time, moisture, bugs, dust, all those types of things. It's really fascinating to me. So yeah, kind of bringing the moth into the front of the picture, I suppose, in this exhibition is quite an interesting layer.
Yeah, I'm also interested in this choice of title for the show, Phone Tree. Would you like to speak a little as to how this title came to you and its relationship between the conceptual underpinnings of the show?
So when I was a kid, I was in a soccer team, and this was prior to like WhatsApp groups or Facebook or things like that. And the way that we would find out whether the game was on or not on was like somebody would call someone and then that person had a duty to call a group of other people and so on and so forth.
Mm.
So this idea of like the phone tree, I remember that being on the fridge and asking my mum and being like, what is a phone tree? And her trying to explain it to me. Oh, this is just how like we pass information down and it's easier that way rather than one person calling 20 parents, you only having to call one or two. And this really kind of like, it's funny, titles, I think, for me, they arrive as opposed to me trying to find a title. It's like once the work is underway, there's titles that sort of like bubble up from other places. And Phone Tree was one of those titles. And to me, because I was thinking a lot about the moth life cycle, and not only obviously do they have this kind of metamorphosis that occurs, right? So like the egg into the larvae into the moth proper. They also undergo a lot of like shedding stages called instars when they're in the larval stage. And I was thinking about like, how do moths transfer information in between these stages? Like what must it be like to undergo a series of like very stark changes across your life? And then generationally as well, how do they pass information along, or how do they pass stories along, or memories or gossip? And so that just got me thinking, right, about like the phone tree and the human like versions of passing down information.
You can just imagine moths gossiping now. That's all I can think about. You spoke a little bit at the beginning. I guess your practice like sits in this exploration of animals, considering our relationship to them as humans. And I think with animals, particularly like moths or other animals we consider as pests, we make these conjectures or assumptions about them. What I guess is quite clear with this show is that it's not meant to be kind of trying to achieve any scientific accuracy within the works, but rather as a relational exploration of these animals' interiority. What kind of interests you generally in exploring this animal and human relationship?
Something that got me, well, not got me started, but like was relevant for this show. I've been making work about animals maybe for like 7 or 8 years now, like specifically about animals and the human relationship with animals. But for this show, I'd read a book by David Pena Guzman called When Animals Dream. And it starts off, he kind of like really, like, it's a great book. He really clearly unfolds like how scientists have done these experiments, right? Where they're trying to observe, first of all, whether animals dream and what animals dream about. Mm. And then he extends this idea of the dream as being evidence of animal imagination, right? And so that is evidence of animal consciousness, sentience, and then what that means in terms of an ethics of human-animal relationship. So he talks about how do we assign animals moral value, so seeing them as equal to humans, or at the very least exceeding how we maybe currently think about animals.
Mm.
So he kind of like does this really beautiful job, right, of like tying together what seems like the simplest question, like what do animals dream about, with, I think, really interesting, pertinent and poignant concerns about how do we value animals in our day-to-day and what impact does that have on how we think about other human beings as well and how we think about the world more generally.
Mm.
So it's not just that the concern is animals and that we should be devoting all our attention to animals, but that once we start to think about that idea, animals have a moral value, then you start to think about other kind of unfoldings from that.
Mm, totally, because I think we as humans have this idea of superiority over other animals. So there's so many, and then there's so many complexities with that, you know, the way that we use animals, the way that we eat animals, the way that animals interact with our lives without us even really realizing it. Like, there's so many places you can take that idea.
Mm.
I want to get into speaking a little about the works in the show more specifically. Each sculptural work in the space kind of examines a different kind of moth and associated moth trap: the pantry moth, guava moth, the spongy moth, clothes moth, and a corn earworm moth. I guess to speak a little to these works, I wanted to speak a little to their material language firstly. How did you kind of approach gathering material and making these individual elements in relation to the different moths each sculpture embodies? Can you speak to me a little bit about the process of selection for sourcing and making these objects?
Yeah, so for me, I was really keen to start with the traps themselves. So like what is in the exhibition is these kind of like five, call them like situations, I suppose, five different sculptures that, as you mentioned, like they reference a specific type of moth, but also that specific moth's trap. And so it started with me buying a whole bunch of these moth traps. Some of the traps we don't have in New Zealand, so I had to get them from overseas, but all of the moths are, like, we do have in New Zealand or have been invasive species in New Zealand. And that was quite important to me to kind of make that distinction between, again, that the close animal as opposed to the far animal, so the one that we could conceivably come in contact with. So it started with the traps themselves, and I felt a little bit stuck until I had received the traps. I did a lot of thinking about this idea of transfer of information and what that meant, like, in a conceptual material sense. So how does the idea of the information transfer make itself felt as a material or an approach to materials? And for me, that then came into thinking about like that no sculpture could be made in a separate piece, which is something I've done before, like the idea of like the simplest possible sculpture I could make. In this instance, I was like, okay, what is the like the most aggregate sculpture I could make? So the sculpture that's made of the most separate parts that I hadn't managed to conceive of in its totality prior to making it. And that was really the way that I went about then, kind of once I had the traps, I sat with the traps and like thought about them for a couple of weeks and like looking at them and disassembling them and kind of considering their strange construction, because these moth traps are mainly made out of like cardboard or plastic or core flute, and they're supposed to be really simple to kind of pop up and make. So they're basically like nets of boxes that then you kind of like construct yourself. So they're intended to be simple, but there's these little interesting kind of twists, so like hole punch pieces or like slots or these folded bits or these traps that look like milk cartons wearing hats. So they're all kind of specific in their own way, and they're all dimensioned really specifically as well. So it was really like a process of getting to know these objects that I'd only seen on the screen. And then that started to kind of get me thinking about other materials in my studio that I've had just sort of sitting there, so I've collected over time, or other kind of approaches like collage. So there's a lot of paper collage in the show. The walls are covered in these very large scale hole punch, I call them drawings, that sit behind the sculptures. So it was like a process of kind of thinking about these individual traps and then breaking them apart and then trying to kind of put them back together, but in a way that they didn't really resemble the original objects anymore. They resembled something else. And then I sort of realized, oh, this thing looks like a something. So this trap looks like a doormat, or this trap looks like a lantern. And I started to kind of make these associations between the strange trap object, which came into my studio, and then a familiar object that could some way act as like an anchor to the sculpture itself, to bring it back down to reality once I had kind of blown it apart and then put it back together again. But in terms of materials, like, I'm very wide-ranging, I suppose. I like to go out to op shops and like purchase secondhand stuff. So a lot of the material that you might see in the show is from op shops, is all from Trade Me, or is things that I've used prior and I've reconfigured them. And then I like to cast things. So there's a lot of the cast objects are plaster or pewter. So I like to kind of work in those two materials as well.
Yeah, I kind of thought that with the kind of material gathering that there was maybe like a little bit of a magpie attitude to finding things.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Often I will like go to an op shop and I just get taken by a specific thing. Like, one set of materials that's in the show is a lot of secondhand envelopes. And that is because I'd go onto an op shop and I'd open this plastic drawer, you know, you just like get to have a fossick around in those places. And all of these beautiful, slightly like weathered, coloured envelopes were there, like all different sizes. It was almost like somebody had a card shop and that this was old stock, but they were all different types. And I just was struck by the beauty of the object, right? And then I bought a whole bunch of them and I took them home. And then they sat in the studio alongside some of the other objects that I'd already collected and alongside the traps. And it's that sort of meeting point for me that's really, really important. And then I'm lucky enough to have had the time to kind of sit in the studio with them, is the meeting point between two or three or four objects is like where the work really happens.
I guess to kind of add to that, you spoke a little bit to it there with the kind of deconstruction and then reconstructing the moth traps into something recognizable but still obscure. I'd love to know a little bit more about how you kind of took those into their final form. Can you walk me through, I guess, a little more specifically to the works, how you went from compiling and forming the individual elements of the sculptures to forming a cohesive sculpture?
Yeah, I think it varies depending on like the different sculptures. So some of them feel like, once I get a couple of objects, for example, there's a work in the show which is like a drawer that's made out of cast crackers. Once I had the crackers in my studio as a snack, like, so like salada crackers, like that kind of very identifiable to me, at least. I don't know whether it is to anyone else, but like the kind of like four crackers that are joined together and then you snap them into quarters. I had those in studio as a snack, and I had the pantry moth trap as well. And I sort of like did this thing where I was like looking from one object to the other, right? The cracker, the trap, the cracker, the trap. And they're like the same scale. So like the square of the trap is the same scale as a salada. And I just was like, okay, that's it, right? Sometimes it can be just the simplest, like, kind of dumbest idea, which for me is like the sweet spot, is like the simple idea that unfolds from there. And then I was like, okay, well, if I were to think about this trap in terms of like the cracker and its relationship and scale to each other, then like what happens next? And I was like, okay, to me it seemed obvious that then I would try to make something out of the crackers, but they're obviously very flimsy. And so then I decided to cast these crackers. And I just was thinking as well, like, okay, so obviously in the pantry there's the drawers, and like moss can be basically anywhere in your pantry, right? So I was thinking about this, the scale of like when you open up a drawer and you're like, oh my gosh, like what has happened to my spices or like seeds or whatever it is that you've got that the moss have eaten.
Mm.
Like that moment of discovery, right? Mm. And so for me, then I was like, it just seemed obvious. So some of them seem really obvious as like a silly idea taken to its like furthest point, and that inside this cracker drawer, the moths have other types of food. So there's rice crackers and pumpkin seeds and almonds, and they're all signed by moths. So they all have moth names on them. What I'm calling moth names.
Yeah, I saw Kathy.
Yeah, so like, I asked friends, like, if you were to name a moth, like, yeah, what would you name a moth? And that was Kathy. Someone's suggestion, yeah, which I thought was brilliant. Yeah, so that one seemed simple. That was kind of almost the first one that really came together, not just as an idea, but as a physical form.
Mm.
And then some of the other ones took longer. I don't know why they take longer. I just think it's just what happens in that instance. So the corn earworm, that was like the last one that really, I struggled with that one because I'd made these, or I'd got these kind of pieces of leather laser cut, and that was simply because I looked at the particular trap and it looked like a handbag. Like it looked like a 1920s like single strap kind of like handbag, like very like dainty in particular.
So chic,
you know, but sticky and awful. And then thinking about this trap as a handbag, that was the initial idea that got me started. But I struggled with the form of what that would be like. And it took me quite a while before realizing that it was maybe not so much a handbag as like a basket or like a bassinet.
Mm.
And it's in the show, it's turned into this bassinet for a corn with a baby corn inside. And there's popcorn underneath. And there's corn recipes on the side with the kind of idea that it's this, the corn earworm moth is training future corn to be delicious corn. Mm-hmm. So it can eat this corn. So yeah, all of the sculptures have their own like logic, I suppose. Like the thing that I'm thinking about in terms of the moth or what it's attempting to do, which really I drew a lot from like Gary Larson's Far Side cartoon. Just kind of the punchline or the silly joke taken really far in service of something else, right? In service of creating that kind of absurd rupture in thinking, which I think we need in terms of animals.
Yeah, I wanted to come back as well. You spoke a little bit to it before, but I want to speak to the walls of the gallery. You've covered them in this almost moth-eaten looking tissue paper, layered collage and hole punch to turn the imagined traces of feeding larvae into large-scale drawings and wrapping the moth situations in the space. Would you like to speak a little to this element of the show and how you see it engaging with the rest of the works in space?
What I wanted to do with the walls was this like extreme difference in scale. The logic was for me, everything on the traps or to do with the sculptures is one-to-one. So it's cast objects or it's been made at the exact scale of the object that I'm trying to reference or the trap that I'm trying to reference. And then everything off the sculptures is at a largely like blown up scale.
Mm.
So on one of the walls, there's a really huge image, which is a detail of a photograph. And the other walls are these almost like if you zoomed in on a piece of paper, these kind of collage tissue paper panels. And then I have hole punched into these kind of pieces of paper, sort of abstract linear drawings that to me reference parts of the traps themselves.
Mm.
So thinking about like what might the moth see if it just sort of glanced at the side of the trap, like a single line of the trap. So yeah, I was really trying to think about what is the scale difference, right, between the human and the moth and the human experience and the moth experience, and what would require us in an exhibition space or an installation to zoom in and out between those two extremes.
Mm.
So coming in and kind of being hit by the scale of the paper on the walls, and then having to go quite close to some of the objects in order to understand what it is they are and to see the kind of combinations of materials and how the lace work is attached or how the pigment is kind of caught on something or the sawdust is on the side of these sculptures. So yeah, thinking about the extreme scale differences was really important to me. And so the drawings became an essential part of that.
And I think there's like certainly an element of, I guess, playfulness and almost absurdity in the works in the show. Imagining the experiences, memories or feelings of moths is not something that people may have really considered before or thought that much about. Can you tell me a little bit more about this, I guess, gravitation towards the absurd and exploring these ideas?
I think that in my own work, it's the thing that comes the easiest, is like having a bit of fun or trying to be a bit silly. I do think that in artwork, it's a under-recognized element, I think, of lots of people's work. And it is, humor is like one of the most difficult things to talk about as an element of artwork, I think, because the second that you want to talk about it is the second that it's not funny anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and so then you've lost, it's a very slippery thing. You've lost the very thing that you're trying to talk about. And it is kind of indescribable or ineffable in that way. And that is where I think that the absurdity has its power, is that for me, the joke never really resolves. Like it's not really about a punchline. It's not really about like a ta-da moment where like someone's supposed to laugh. Rather, it's about kind of inserting like a foot in the door and kind of going, well, isn't this weird? Mm. Isn't this strange? Don't you feel strange? Isn't this funny? Isn't this totally absurd, the way that we think about these things, or the way that, perhaps I should say, the way that I think about these things. Yeah, so for me, it is the thing that is completely essential to the work that I make and how I think about things. But it is also the most difficult thing to talk about, I think.
That was artist Lucy Mayle speaking to me about her current solo exhibition in the changing room at Gus Fisher Gallery, Phone Tree. Phone Tree is on now until the 22nd of August, so check it out.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
You're listening to Various Artists on 95BFM. We'll be right back.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
I believe in like the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out.
Josh Auraki from Te Whatu Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
Here comes the box with a musical star, with 1,000 tons of burden.
That's to me, one and only.
Pinky Jim.
Pinky Groove.
Pinky Jim, save the goals.
Pinky Jim.
Pinky Groove.
Crisp biscuits and fresh vegetables every Tuesday from 7 p.m. Replayed 4 a.m. Wednesday and always online at 95bfm.com. Check it.
Oh, that's a good art.
Emma Fitz is an Ōtautahi-based interdisciplinary artist working amongst sculpture, photography and textile installation, drawing from an expanded painting practice in which the canvas is reimagined as an active material in itself, creating its own imagery and form while also behaving as its own support structure, resulting in these immersive material-rich spaces that contemplate architecture, textiles, queer history, feminism and memory. In her current exhibition on at Melanie Roger Gallery, Emerald Pools, Fitz explores the notions of memory through the revisitation of a work first exhibited in the courtyard at Object Space in 2022 as Lapping at Your Door, and later reconfigured for the installation of The Air Like a Stone presented at the Physics Room in 2023. The work then undertook another reconfiguration and is now back here in Tamaki at Melanie Roger Gallery presented as Emerald Pools. Through each of its reconfigurations, the work has built up this rich history, holding residue of its past lives and allowing the work's memories of reconfiguration, weather exposure, and reinstallation to become embedded within the work itself. Alongside the memory of the work's various iterations, the work also holds the history of its own making process at its forefront, with Fitz purposefully exposing the work's methods of construction, open raw seams and canvas folds, shifting the viewer's attention to not only the work itself, but also the wider histories a work might hold. The show becomes a site of multiplicity, holding the work's accumulative history of its prior context, configurations, and surrounding dialogues. I caught up with Emma about the show and her overall practice.
My name's Emma Fitz. I'm an artist currently based in Ototahi, Christchurch, and I'm currently up here in Tamaki, after having installed and just opened last night a new exhibition, Emerald Pools, at Melanie Roger Gallery. Yeah, my practice stems from a kind of painting background and then great interest in textiles and feminist histories and overlooked historical figures as well, and architecture. So those are all things that sort of get entwined into, yeah, an installation type practice, I guess.
Yeah, beautiful. And as you mentioned, your current exhibition at Melanie Roger Gallery, Emerald Pools, presents the revisitation of a body of work first presented in the courtyard at Object Space in 2022, titled Lapping at Your Door. It was then later reconfigured through the presentation of The Air Like a Stone at the Physics Room in 2023. I'd like to start off this conversation around Emerald Pools by speaking a bit to the work's histories and its initial points of orientation. What was the premise for the first iteration of this work at Object Space?
That was a courtyard plinth project. So Object Space, I think it's every year, puts out a call for proposals from artists who want to do an installation on their courtyard plinth. So it's an outside space. Mm. I put a proposal in for that and was really interested in making something there that sort of worked with the amazing architecture of the gallery, and the Object Space is interested in architecture and craft and objects. So I was trying to think of something tying in with those ideas. And I was looking a lot to the work of Eileen Gray at the time and her house that she had designed called E1027 in the south of France, and in particular these awning structures that she had outside the house. So I was taking some cues from those and decided to make this sort of awning structure of my own, which is made out of coloured and dyed canvas in a shape that kind of created a little holding space, I guess, outside of the gallery. I wanted to make a space where possibly people could come inside under, come within the courtyard plinth and hang out, or just have this moment where they could, that was both sort of public and private.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so kind of making this intimate space in that kind of outside, but also very architectural. It kind of hovers quite between a lot of spaces.
I really like that about Eileen Gray's work. In her interior designs, she's often she uses lots of curves and thinks about places of moments of intimacy, I guess, so where you can create smaller, she uses lots of walls that don't go right up to the ceiling, or there'll be places where you can kind of have a closer moment, I guess. But then it doesn't feel claustrophobic either, because you can see above that, see over that wall that doesn't go right up to the ceiling. Or I like a lot of her designs, she's really conscious of the exit, which I quite like. So you can always see a way out, even though wherever you are, you feel as private as well. So I was sort of thinking about that with that courtyard plinth, that I created a curve that went around two sides of the plinth but not right to the end, so there was you could just pop in that way, or you could also pop out the other side as well. And there, the canvas that I used was, you couldn't see through it, but it was kind of luminous, I guess, so it, and the colour radiated, so it wasn't, yeah, it wasn't like a dead space in a way. Yeah, you create a very intimate space. That's, yeah, hard to describe without any pictures, but...
Yeah. And how did the work then reconfigure through the presentation of the air like a stone at the physics room?
That happened through, conversations with Abby Cunane, who was the director of the physics room at the time. And Abby had written a text for me and for Object Space with the work Lapping at Your Door at Object Space. So there'd already been this kind of like dialogue, I guess, with that work. And then Abby was curating a show at the physics room and asked, yeah, about doing this reconfiguration of those canvas works. We were both interested in them because they'd been through this weathering process. Mm-hmm. Interested to see what it would be like to reconfigure and represent those canvases. But yeah, the way, because they had been, I think it was about a year that they were up at Object Space. Yeah. And so that was part of the initial idea as well. I was like interested to see how the canvases would fade or be affected by, the cityscape. There's lots of building happening around Object Space at that time. A new building was popping up over the road. So lots of dust and building debris kind of being sort of filtered over onto the work. Though over that year, there was a lot of rain. So the canvases had a bit of mildew on them. So a couple of times had to, flew up and was wiping down and cleaning the canvases by using a diluted bleach solution. So trying to stop the mildew encroaching. And yeah, it's sort of, I really liked it's a sort of patina that the canvases got over that year and wanted to, show that, I guess. And it's also not often that you get to work in that way, or I feel like with making art, there's often this pressure to make, and you're working towards a deadline pretty quickly. Mm. And I'll say, oh, this is really amazing that this is a work that has a different engagement with time, and one that I really like and I'm really interested in.
Yeah, often you make works for shows and then they're then sold, and it's that life of that artwork isn't necessarily shown for the wider public. It's more, it's now in the life of the person or the space that then has it, and it's you don't see that all the different kind of spaces it's within, all its histories and connections that it has over its course.
Yeah, it's suddenly gone, or it's out of your hands and control.
And now we see the work currently showing at Melanie Roger Gallery here in Tamaki. How have you approached the revisitation and configuration of the works this time round? Has the specific space of the gallery and its context here reshaped and shifted the work?
It has changed again. When it was at the physics room, it was in the front gallery. It was in the window space there. It was where the reading room or library was, and we shifted that out of there, and because we wanted to have the work engage with the windows. And it was about at a similar time, actually, well, closer to Matariki when it was shown in Christchurch. So when the light is, the days are shorter, so the light is low. So we're wanting the sun and kind of moon to pass over the work in that window space. And this time, that interaction with light has been interesting again. It's really long in this configuration. It's 6 or 7 meters.
Yeah.
And I really wanted it to be in one line. So that, in a way, was an easy decision for placement because there's only two walls that are long enough to show the work like that. But Melanie's gallery has some windows that are quite high, and yesterday I was noticing how the light passes over the work and then actually onto the end wall where there is nothing, but the diffusion of light on that white wall is really nice as well. It sort of softens and fades and makes a nice reflection that then makes you look at the subtleties of colour and shades in the work as well. So for Melanie's gallery, it was more about placing the work
kind of high, so the work starts to then activate the whole space. Yeah, just little decisions like that, I guess.
Yeah, the work itself holds such a rich history, holding the residue of those past lives that you were just talking about, allowing the memories of reconfiguration and weather exposure and reinstallation to become embedded within the work itself, along with these visible methods of storage and construction being held within the work through the prominent seams and folds of the fabric. Can you speak a little bit to this idea of the work holding this accumulation history within history and memory within its surface, and why that's important for you personally and also the work itself?
Yeah, I think I have it probably comes from just this real interest in textiles and clothing, I guess, and wanting to draw people's attention to a kind of textile and tactile knowledge that I think we all have and know a lot about. I love the history of textiles. I think textiles are an amazing material that speak about time in an interesting way. Like, they are, textile is one of the first things that has been around humans, and probably one of the first processes that we were involved with. So I like that when we're holding a textile, they speak of this incredibly long history of humankind, and then they're also incredibly contemporary. We always need textiles, clothing, and textiles in itself speaks to crosses time really beautifully. I like the way with textiles and with fabric that both the method, so its construction and its form, are simultaneous in a way. So when you're making a textile, or when a textile is made, you're crossing the threads, the warp and the weft, and weaving. You're both making its form and its surface at the same time. It's all the interconnectedness, I guess, of a textile that is, form and structure and surface, I like. And then the way that that time from 2022 and 2023 has been embedded in these works in a similar, well, not in a similar way, but is now embedded in the works too, through my painting colour onto the canvases, and then an erasure as well through my cleaning them, or them being weathered and sun damaged, or cleaned, plus extra things being put on top of them, like debris or mold, or I like the messiness of that. Yeah, and also I think something about them not being clean too, and that being shown in the gallery, I really am enjoying. I feel we're not exposed to that much griminess, obviously, in the gallery or just in life, kind of at the moment. So it's quite nice to get people up close to this kind of mildew in a way, even though it's very subtle, but we'll see the beauty in that. It's not a clean, glossy surface. It's it's weathered, it's dirty, but it's rich,
Because often in gallery spaces we see this kind of, pristine, finished version of a product, and we don't see all of those kind of messy iterations, unfinishedness of all the stuff that leads up to that final surface and presentation of a work.
Yeah.
So by you kind of pulling all of these things into focus, all that residue, all those kind of marks to make people kind of ponder and think about that a little more.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been nice thinking about that. And also I play with that a little bit too in the construction of it. So sometimes, in Emerald Pools at Melanie Roger Gallery, I have deconstructed the canvases slightly too. So they were folded at Object Space,
they're now lying flat at Melanie Rogers, so the back becomes the front too. And then often I'll, rather than hiding a seam as you would in a regular garment, I'll put the seam forward. trying to hide things that, or trying to make present things that are often hidden, trying to not do that. But yeah, I think you have to like be conscious about showing those things or not making things too clean and tidy, because I feel like that's often it's what we're taught, or like so consciously not doing that.
Yeah, and you use these somewhat conventional painting materials of canvas and paint, but through your altered approach and application, they shift into something more sculptural and architectural, shifting the canvas beneath the painted surface into this playful, embodied experimentation. Can you speak a bit to your approach and kind of, almost like reconfiguration of a typical painting itself and the materials used within that?
Yeah, I use flash paint, which is like a vinyl base paint. It's really highly pigmented, and I like it because it's you can water it down, which is what I do, and I'll do lots and lots of washes over the canvas with it, and it's very flexible. It's a paint that I think can be used in sign writing, and it's waterproof, it's very durable, and you can be quite, well, I guess all paint, but the way I use it is I really either let it like really soak into the canvas, or I really rub it in, and I think, and you don't need to prime your canvas. It's one of the things I love about it. So there's no, to me conceptually, I see that my using that paint is like becomes, it seeps into the canvas, so it's not on top of it. And I guess that leads into those ideas I was talking about before of weaving and textiles, enjoying that because everything is like interconnected and working together. And I think, even when I was painting at art school, I was never really wanting to paint a picture on the canvas. I was folding the canvas or scrunching it or pressing it, trying to get the canvas to create its own image and also its own support structure. Even though I am using paint, I feel like I'm trying to use it in a way that sits with that idea.
So it's no longer that kind of, here's the canvas and here's the paint. It's kind of they meld into each other and kind of become one and almost function as one in some capacity.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah. And through your making process, do you often like pre-plan a lot, or is it more intuitive letting like that experimentation and responding to the works as you're making it?
Yeah, I think it's quite intuitive. Well, that object space work was a different kind of work for me. I guess there was a design problem in a way with that installation, so that I knew that the size and I had a structure for where the canvas had to go. So there was that restriction. But then for the colour and the construction techniques that I'm using within that, that's sort of a mixture. Like I'll have, perhaps a bit of an idea, but then it's very much, going, I don't know, it sounds cheesy, going with the flow, but just like, working a bit more intuitively.
And you previously mentioned these references to historical women. Do you want to speak a little bit to more how those references play into the making of the work?
Yeah, I am always like looking around for inspirational figures, I guess, and people who are living or have lived lives in ways that I find inspiring or like want to know more about. Yeah, I think as artists, we approach life a little differently, or it's like hard to, well, not hard, but I like having, seeing. I think it's quite hard, has been in the past, like hard to, there's like mystery around the artist too. And then I was just always curious about like, but how did they really do it? Like what were the artists like
relationships like, or I don't know, just wanting to know more of the nitty-gritty of how these people lived. So I think probably in like when I did the Olivia Spencer Bauer residency in 2014, like back then just started, I wanted to know more about the life of Olivia Spencer Bauer. I was sort of disappointed by the like lack of information on her life, or so I just started researching her and talking to people that knew her because people were still alive at the time. And through that process, like, I guess the stories got a little messy as well. Like when you start talking to people, you get conflicting stories. And then I just decided to draw into that project other people that I'd been looking at as well, to kind of create this imaginative dialogue between Olivia and these other women. But yeah, they're often women, often queer women, or people that I just feel have been underrepresented in history. My projects used to be more direct at particular people, and now that I feel a bit more, or have been doing it for longer, I guess, I feel like the figures that I look at, they're not so at the forefront of the project, but there's always people floating around.
Yeah, it's almost like an approach to them. Like you can never fully maybe understand everything, but it's this approach and this leaning towards in hopes of some kind of dialogue or conversation by bringing these different voices somewhat into that room together.
Yeah.
In some way.
Yeah, I think so. I think the imagination is such an amazing research tool. You know, that's how you make progress, is like by imagining new situations or I guess I like thinking about possible conversations or when you use imagination like that as a research tool, you can cross time as well, that you can create conversations between different centuries and different disciplines like science and art or design or literature. And yeah, I find that really fun. And there's a companionship, I guess, too, in that, because it can be, you know, it's isolating also being an artist and doing your own weird, like, research. I did used to collaborate with actual people in the past, but have done that less and less. And I think, yeah, this way of looking to these historical figures or as a kind of desire to continue to collaborate, but in a way that, I'm very present in as well. Yeah.
That was Emma Fitz speaking to me about Emerald Pools, which is currently on at Melanie Rodger Gallery until the 27th of June.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
We'll be right back.
Coisas que acontecem em curto tempo não se sujeitam ao consenso, ficam no fundo enquanto o resíduo perece. We'll be right back.
acontecem no contratempo, não se sujeitam ao consenso, ficam no fundo enquanto o resíduo perece. Sabedorias feitas na manga servem ao estado presente, ficam distinto enquanto a maioria embarga.
The 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists.
It's paintings in that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tamaki Makaurau, as mentioned on the show, Lucy Mail's solo exhibition Phone Tree is on in the changing room at Gus Fisher Gallery until the 22nd of August. Also on at Gus Fisher Gallery is Studies for a Keepsake, an exhibition showing Claude Cahoon and Marcel Moore, also on until the 22nd of August.
As also mentioned on the show, Emma Fitt's solo exhibition Emerald Pools is on at Melanie Roger Gallery until the 27th of June.
Opening tonight at the Arts House Trust at Parr Homestead are two new exhibitions. Retail, a group exhibition of contemporary object makers working across ceramics, jewellery, installation and design, as well as a new solo exhibition by Nova Paul Puawananga that's on from 5:30 till 7:30 p.m.
Also opening tonight at Puku Room is a new solo exhibition by Hannah Ireland, Making Faces, that's on from 6 p.m.
Nico Hinden and Naminapu Meimuru White's Cosmologies is on at Te Uru Waitakere Contemporary Gallery until the 9th of August.
Room has two new exhibitions which open this week, Day for Night by Finn Godbolt and Mitchell McGrath. Also on is Gregarious Bloom by Drenico Hawthorne.
Ma Sheng Feng Ho, a solo exhibition by Audrey Goggin, is on at Window Gallery until the 24th of June.
The Blue Dome by Selena Oshadi is on at Artspace Aotearoa until the 4th of July. Artspace Aotearoa is also seeking expressions of interest from early career artists to participate in Crit sessions as part of their forthcoming exhibition, Crit Art Learning Since 1987. Applications close this Sunday, 14th of June. For more information, head to their website.
And on at Season Aotearoa are two exhibitions, If I Offered You My Fingernails, Would You Take Them? By Melanie Tangaire Baldwin and Colouring in Stone by Monique Schreiser. Both are on until the 27th of June. If you have something you want on the Art Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa e kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for various artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us today.
Lucy Mail.
And Emma Fitz.
Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com or check out our Instagram at 95bfm various artists for more.
Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. Next up is the Land of the Good Groove with Mari. My name is Soph.
I'm Maya.
And that was various artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM.
Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.